the next case.
John versus BNX Gas Company and another.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman representing Nella Kate Dye. Terrence Shea Cook and Chip Casola are with me at council table, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal focuses on whether the severance deeds at issue from the 1880s conveyed rights to the gas which lies beneath Ms. Dye's land. Notably, the deeds never specifically mention oil or gas or coal bed methane. They simply pass, quote, minerals. The circuit court ruled, as a matter of law and at the demurrer stage, that gas rights were conveyed through the deed's use of the words minerals. And in doing so, the court basically adopted defendants' claims that this case is controlled by a 1936 decision of this court, Warren versus Clinchfield Coal. Not surprisingly, the parties diverge widely on what this Warren case actually stands for. Ms. Dye's position is that Warren created at most a presumption that the term minerals includes oil and gas in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, but the presumption can be overcome by competent evidence, and evidence was allowed in the Warren case because the phrase was not clear. You allow evidence.
But the evidence that was allowed confirmed the majority consensus view.
Correct, but it was specifically permitted. It was assigned error by Mr. Warren, and this court said, yes, it's relevant, let it in.
Right, but it does diminish the strength of the interpretation that you have the right to rebut with contrary evidence. The language of the sentence you refer to, it's a little ambiguous, but it says, while the final authority was upon the court to construe the written instrument, we see no reason to complain of its action in calling to its aid those competent to speak on the subject. It's just a peculiar way of saying what you and I would say today with our present vocabulary, that you can have extrinsic evidence when there's an ambiguity in a written instrument.
Well, it is a very unusual case, which we grant. It is a very strange case, but the evidence was admitted, and I think what you find is that even there, the deed in that case had different language from the deed here. It was minerals of every description. Now, what you find...
But your argument is premised on the fact that the deed is ambiguous.
Correct.
Okay.
It is. And there's two different ways to go with that, and maybe I was going to talk about how this court has treated the word minerals, and I'll do that in a second, but just getting to the ambiguity, you know, as we said in our brief, consistent with the Rasnake decision, you know, there are a number of different ways that it's hard to know what this deed meant. Parties could understand mineral in the colloquial mass of mankind sense, per the Bury decision, to mean just something solid and not a gas. Parties could interpret minerals in the expansive scientific sense, which is what was allowed in the Warren case because the experts came in. And again, we're at a demurrer, and I think that's important. If you look at page 251 and page 261, the experts specifically said the fact that this is minerals of every description does matter. And demurrer, we're entitled to every inference, and we'd like to take it. In fact, Clinchfield Coal at page 269 of their brief in that case also focused on how broad that language is. But regardless,
the holding in Warren is that the term mineral includes gas unless there is some indication in the language in the deed that the parties intended otherwise. So how does that language that you're referring to indicate otherwise?
I don't mean to parse words, but I will try. The holding, I think, And the last line is, in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, the deed under which complainant derived title embraces all petroleum, oil, and gas, and that's minerals of every description. But I grant you, it does, and it starts at page 284 in the circuit court's opinion. It does say, we're going to say minerals are part of, gas is part of minerals, unless there's something that shows that it's not. And that's a presumption, but it's not. The fact that one litigant chose not to put on one shred of evidence or make an allegation, it's very interesting. At page 283 of the joint appendix, the lower court's decision says, you know, you didn't allege anything, you didn't put on any evidence, I can't really help you, even if you write something in your brief about history and custom at the time. So what you really have here is a presumption. And that's what the court created. And what does that mean? Well, if we're at equipoise, I guess the presumption carries the day. But if we put on any evidence, then we should get past the presumption. We do have the burden of production there. If we're like Warren and we do nothing, I guess we lose. But in this case, we did a lot more than Warren. We did a great deal more. And we would also have the burden of persuasion, I guess, ultimately, if there's a presumption.
Is the rebutting case that you proffer, do we have to tier that? In other words, is the rebutting case, as you understand it, which it would be sufficient, simply general rebuttal that the custom and practice in the industry in such date was XYZ, or should the rebuttal case be limited to the parties, their negotiations, their language in the deed, stuff like that?
Historically, and here's where I'll switch over to the case law, historically this case has done the circumstances. We look at the circumstances, and that's why it's sort of, we're looking at historical deeds. And the reason I think for that is the deeds are interpreted as of the time that they're written. And in the 1880s, there's no one left to tell us what actually happened. So what kind of things do we want to know? Well, we want to know, was there a market, perhaps, for gas at that time? Did the material have a value? That's what the court looked at in White. And the answer was no for coal. And here, that's the same answer. Nobody knew about CBM in 1880. Was there a means of transportation if they actually got gas? No, there wasn't in the 1880s. What was the prevailing view of the world? It was the Dunham Rule. It was Pennsylvania law, but a speculator would know.
That's not a prevailing rule today.
It's not. No, it is not. It is the minority rule now. But in answer to Justice Kelsey's question, if we're looking at the time, that makes it very relevant that Mr. Gillespie, and this is at page 327, there's a list of all the places where he made deeds, and sometimes he put in gas, and sometimes he didn't. Most of the time he didn't.
But I apologize for interrupting once again.
Sure.
But I'm trying to understand the nature of the rebuttal case. If the presumption that Warren embraces is the weight of authority is to affect petroleum, oil, and gas or minerals. That's a presumption. That's based upon an assessment, a social assessment of the custom and practice of this area of life during these epochs of time. Rebuttal cases generally don't go after the grounds for the presumption. They go after exceptions to a presumption. Do you follow me so far? So I can easily see a rebuttal case where, no, we have actual evidence of the parties to this agreement, and they did not mean this. They had another clause in the deed that alludes to this contract or whatever. You follow what I'm saying?
I do follow what you're saying, and I'm going to divert again. Eventually, I am going to get to the cases like Bury and White and Schaefer, because they're all our way, and none of them go out as a matter of law. But, for example, in this case, Mr. Lowe allows Gillespie to use water. Well, if all means all, if all minerals went to the company, water is a mineral. Warren's own expert said that at JA-265, so it's in the record. But they didn't mean all minerals. Same, Mr. Lowe says, you know, that's another problem with this all means all argument. It would include the surface. And that's what this court says in FIPS and in Shores. We know when we're talking about minerals, all doesn't mean all, or the surface holder would give away the surface. So it means something less. And that's the inherent, you know, I started to talk about the inherent ambiguity because in this case, the ambiguity, you know, extends also to use of the word mining. I mean, everything in here talks about mining. Nothing about drilling, nothing about gas. It's pretty clear the railroad had just come in. We're talking about minerals, solid matter being mined and transported by rail. The parties clearly didn't intend for there to be gas here. And that brings us back to Bury. I mean, Bury, this is a quote from Bury. The term mineral is not a definite one, capable of a definition of universal application, but is susceptible of limitation according to the intention of the parties using it. And the Bury Court went on to aptly describe the dilemma in construing the term minerals in a scientific context where everything is classified broadly as animal, vegetable, or mineral. Many things are technically minerals, but the Bury Court cautioned it is rare, if ever, that mineral is intended in this sense in ordinary transactions. And in fact, it went on to say, ordinarily, mineral is used to denote a class of things less comprehensive. Well, what does less mean? It means ambiguity. It means we have to look. And this drilling issue is important. If we look at Bury, the question was, is quarrying allowed? And the court said no. And let me also say that the language...
It's a limestone case, right?
That's the limestone case. And right. Strip mining in FIPS. And all of those also said all the minerals. Bury, all the metals and minerals of every kind. White, all such minerals as may be found. FIPS, all the coal, mineral products. This court has always looked at the circumstance and the context. Although in this case we have the bonus that it is clear on the face with the water... And also the I demand surface rights to timber myself, Lowe says. I think those are at page 9.
How do you deal with the recent Rasnick case that you just referenced? Because even though that case was a CBM case, the term was minerals.
Correct.
In that case as well.
Rasnick, we think, helps us because it says ambiguity. See, this isn't the final decision. This is just getting past go. This is our day in court. And it says if there's more than one way to look at this, then it's ambiguous and let's go look at it. Let's let people put on their evidence. And that's exactly what we think. It could be the mass of mankind, Bury definition. It could be the scientific one that got used in Warren. It could just be the parties simply didn't consider gas. That's the danger with what we have here, is that we're being asked to accept a inference that by leaving something out that most people didn't know about, which is what this court said in Harrison Wyatt.
Well, if we decide as a matter of law that gas is included in minerals, nothing's left out.
I'm sorry?
I said, if we decided as a matter of law that gas is included within the term of minerals, which is the prevailing view in the country, then nothing would have been left out.
But in 1880, we're looking at the intent, 1888, 87, 86, we're looking at the intention of the parties at that time. And here, it's really pretty clear that Mr. Gillespie used gas occasionally when he wanted to and didn't hear.
Right, but other than, I mean, all the cases that we're talking about in the majority on this issue, the severance deeds for the most part, except on federal lands, were in the 1800s.
In Warren...
Maybe early 1900s.
In Warren, the court looked at other deeds. It looked at evidence. Exactly what you're saying. So then why can't we put on all this evidence of Gillespie? That's all we're trying to do. We're just trying to do what the parties were allowed to do in Warren, because we're here to demur. I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right.
May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Blank, and on behalf of Lena Busker, we represent the Appalachian CNX Gas Company. I also introduce Blair Gardner, who's here with Eric Weitzel. Blair Gardner has been pro-hocked in pursuant to an order on Joint Appendix 65. Mr. Gardner will deal specifically with questions on ambiguity. I'll deal with questions on stare decisis and demur, along with my argument. My argument's really threefold. Reaffirm Warren v. Clinchfield. Affirm Judge Moore's opinion below, and answer the question, what should they do? Now, who are they? They are Virginia title examiners, Virginia attorneys, Virginia circuit court judges, production companies, and even you, this Supreme Court. And why do I say, what should they do? What should they do when they're faced with a deed from the same year, from the same county, with virtually the identical language that's found in Warren v. Clinchfield? The title examiner should opine that minerals include gas, because since 1936, that's what this Commonwealth's rule has stood for. What should the trial attorney do when they're faced with a declaratory judgment or a trespass complaint from a surface owner that is claiming the gas when the gas from the mineral owner? Since 1936, a trial attorney should demur based on Warren v. Clinch. What should the circuit court do, like Judge Moore, when he or she is confronted with that demur? They should do exactly what Judge Moore did and cite to Warren v. Clinchfield. Minerals include gas. The language of the deed is virtually identical. What should the production company do, or the mineral owner, when faced with risking millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to invest in this commonwealth? That production company should say, since 1936, minerals include gas, and they should invest the money in this commonwealth. And what should this Supreme Court do? This Supreme Court should do exactly what Warren v. Clinchfield said. They should answer the exact same question. Are petroleum, oil, and gas minerals? The answer is in the affirmative.
Well, Warren did accept that there could be a showing of contrary intent and thus rebut the legal presumption that you're referring to that Warren certainly adopted. The hard question, seems to me, is how do you define the scope of the rebuttal case? Their rebuttal case is, well, basically an attack on the presumption itself and the grounds for the presumption. But it seems to me there's got to be some ground for some legitimate ability to say, look, in this particular deed, given this language, I'm going to use the other language, in these particular parties, do you see the distinction I'm trying to draw?
I do, Justice Kelsey, and I think the answer is in Camp v. Camp, 220 Virginia 595, Treslin Land Company versus Virginia Holding, 228 Virginia 1319. You have to look at the four corners of the deed.
So if you find the inconsistency that triggers that open door within the deed itself, then you go to the rebuttal case.
Absolutely. And here you've got a deed that's identical in, or virtually identical, that you had in Warren v. Clinchfield. So you can't go beyond the four corners to get to the presumption. You can't manufacture the ambiguity when the deed is the same. That's the problem with the quagmire that they're in, and it's the perfect question that you ask. What is that presumption? What else can you put in there? You have to look at the four corners of the deed. If there's something in the four corners of the deed that would lead you to some ambiguity or something that shows the counter intent of the parties, maybe you can get there. But when you've got a deed, again, that's got virtually the identical language, we're done. And the reason why, and Range Resources in their amicus brief, it's a beautiful brief on stare decisis. That's one of the reasons that you need it. You need the certainty to answer the question, what should they do? What should the title examiner, the trial attorney, the circuit court judge, and this Supreme Court do? If you don't have something within the four corners of the deed, you can't manufacture it with something that's in a complaint or manufacture it with some historical reference. You've got to stick to the four corners of the deed. And that's really the argument that I came here to make. This court should respectfully answer the question the same, that minerals include gas. The same answer that, in our opinion, the answer must be an affirmative. And respectfully, the court should reaffirm Warren v. Clinchfield. Don't overturn 80 years of precedent that people have relied on for countless mineral conveyances and investments in this commonwealth. That would be a terrible, terrible result. You should deny this appeal, and you should affirm Judge Moore's opinion.
Can you take some time to address the three cases that they indicate?
Absolutely. The Burry case and the White and the Shores v. Schaefer. Well, first of all, White and Burry predated Warren v. Clinchfield. But the way that I look at the Burry case, the Shores case, and the Phipps case is within those cases you had a real big distinction. You can't the destruction of the surface, which was reserved, is the big distinction in those cases. The limestone case that you were talking about in Burry. You can't, the minerals, again, in that case, if the surface was reserved and you have to destroy the surface to get to the limestone, that's the distinction. The same thing in Shores. Sand is not a mineral in terms of deed-granting surface if you have to destroy the surface to get to the sand. That's the distinction in those cases. But again, you don't have that here. You have a deed with virtually the identical language. And again, this idea, and then I'll turn the podium over to Mr. Gardner, this idea that somehow the additional language of every description has some difference. That is a distinction without a difference. All covers it. All minerals cover it. And if you look at the Warren decision, the question wasn't, are petroleum, oil, and gas minerals of every description? It was, are petroleum, oil, and gas minerals? That was the question. And with giving my last few seconds, Justice Lemons in the last case said you have to deal with it in the actual case law that has been passed. The actual case law that was passed was in 1936. It was Warren v. Clinchfield. We should follow Warren v. Clinchfield. And I'll turn the podium over to Mr. Gardner. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Blair Gardner, and I'm pleased to be here this morning on behalf of Buckhorn Coal. Justice McClanahan, if I might follow up on the question that you put to Mr. Blank, specifically about the three cases of Beery, Phipps, Shore that were brought up. I absolutely agree with the description that Mr. Blank gave about the limestone case, the Beery case, and it was equally applicable 30 years later in the sand and gravel case involving Shores. But I want to make a specific point about Phipps. Now, this was the case that came before this court in 1976. It involved a grant of coal and of all coal in Dickinson County. It involved, however, some of the coal only being able to be mined by surface methods, which were not available when the deed was entered in 1902. In that case, for the same reasons consistent with Beery and Shores, the court declined to impose a method of mining that would have been utterly destructive of the surface if it had been carried out. But there is nothing in that case that suggests that because they couldn't mine the coal, that the coal belonged to the surface owner. Quite the contrary. The court was very explicit in that case that the reason they couldn't mine it is they were going to destroy the surface and the parties would have to negotiate over what were called the stripling rights in that case. But the Phipps case actually supports the position we're making, which is in part that the pertinent rights that are also found in the two severance deeds at issue are in no way lessen the rights to the minerals. Now, much is made of the fact that one of the deeds refers to mining and removing the coal and other minerals by railway and somehow suggesting that it was the presence of the use of the word railway that is descriptive of what could be mined. Well, the actual language in that Lockhart deed says that the grantee, Mr. Gillespie, was allowed to pass over and through lands by railway or otherwise. The Lowe deed is no less restrictive. It just said it could pass by right-of-way over, under, and through the lands that were granted in that deed. Both deeds granted a right to erect buildings or to occupy the land with buildings and machinery. There was nothing that suggested that somehow the mining and removing of the coal and minerals, which is repeated throughout each of the deeds, was somehow limited to just the coal. This is also consistent with what the Warren Court found in 1936. The pertinent rights in that case were almost identical to the ones we find here. And it and the fact that there was no reference to drilling, that there is no reference to wells or derricks, which we would understand today to be the technology employed to recover coal bed methane or conventional natural gas, in any way restricted the inclusion of gas in a grant of all minerals.
So your point is, within the four corners, it's very possible in this industry to find language in a deed that might, in fact, tip against the presumption.
Your Honor, if I might respond, yes. The analysis that was laid out by Mr. Blank in response to your previous question, I think, is exactly the analysis that the court provides in Warren and is subsequently upheld in almost all of the cases that describe and analyze what arises or what has to arise to find an ambiguity. First and foremost, it must always arise within the four corners of the instrument, as it did in the Rasnick case. It cannot be manufactured extrinsically by reference to a recitation of historical information, which was largely what was pleaded in the complaints in this case. But to give you a specific example, if there were a grant of coal and similar minerals, or a grant of coal and solid minerals, that standing alone without anything else to reference a deed might create an ambiguity, which then, as I understand the law of the Commonwealth, would allow a party to present extrinsic evidence as to the intention of the parties to a deed. That's not what we have here. In fact, Your Honor, there was actually no actual pleading in the original or the subsequently amended complaints that the two severance deeds were actually ambiguous. That term is never used. We heard a great deal about it in the arguments made before the trial court, in the briefing that was done for the trial court, that there is no actual allegation of ambiguity in the complaints themselves. Another point I would make in respect to the pertinent rights is that Virginia has generally been liberal in allowing the employment of newer technologies to recover minerals, so long as, in the Bury Crate case, it's not destroying what's otherwise been retained or granted. That's why in Bury, you cannot open a limestone quarry on lands that would have destroyed the surface, or why you could use strip mining rights in the surface coal case. Finally, there's no need to harmonize, as has been suggested by the appellant. Warren with Bury, the cases are not in tension. As we described in our brief, they are completely consistent. What the court has tried to do is maintain the estates granted or reserved by each of the parties when there comes a tension to the recovery of a particular mineral. There is no tension in this case because the use of the surface for purposes of recovering the coal bed methane is minimal. It's barely invasive. I am just about out of time, and I will just summarize by saying, like Mr. Blank, that the decision in the Warren case entered in 1936 has created 80 years of legal stability and has made the creation of the coal bed methane production industry in this state possible. The appellant has offered no valid reasons for disrupting that stability. The circuit court correctly applied the analysis of this court in Warren to the fact of the case. We ask the court to affirm the decision and dismiss the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Friedman?
The deeds are not identical. Of every description matters, and their experts in Warren said it mattered. As Justice Kelsey asked, you know, if you want to see some indication that all doesn't mean all, look at the reference to water. Lowe wouldn't be giving the claim, use the water. They would own it. It's a mineral. Real quickly, though, Bury was not reversed, neither was White. They're still good law, and they say minerals is ambiguous. And closing, the title examiner's book at section 30-1 quotes Bury on minerals. It doesn't cite Warren.
All right. Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.